The following program will feature discussion of domestic violence and child abuse. Listener discretion advised.
You're listening to Africans with Disabilities in NAM, a 1 hour special for 3CR's Disability Day broadcast for 2019. In this program, you'll hear from Hamale Ibrahim, who assists other African community members navigate the health system, employment, and government services. Later, you'll hear from Farah Muzodza on self-management of NDIS planning for her son with autism. You'll also hear from Sirius Meerkat on non-Western modalities of healing from trauma. Stay tuned.
I live in Dandenong area, southeast. So there's a lot of immigrant families there from different part of the continent. So we have a huge Oromo population. We have Somalis, both Somali from Somalia and also like Somali Kenyans. And then we also have a couple of Togolese, Cameroonians, Malians. We also have families from Sierra Leone, Liberia, Senegal. We also have families from Gambia, South Sudan, and just one family from Guinea. I mostly do forms, like filling in forms, any forms to do with Centrelink, anything to do with taxation, medical forms, migration or immigration, anything that needs like filling, if someone is trying to apply for something, including like if they're trying to apply for like jobs and things like that, or if they are doing like job searches, because most of them can't read and write. So anything to do with like just reading and writing, and they're like, or they get a letter and I need to like go through the letters and be like, okay, this is what it says. If there is an action that needs to be followed up, so I'll be like, okay, so there is, these are the things that you need to do, or these are the things that need to be done. And I often also do all of that, or whatever it's required. And that varies from like communities. So it can be in Dandenong. I might be in Dandenong in the morning, and then in the afternoon I might be in Barrick or Nariwaren. I can be in Nobel Park or in Springvale. And sometimes I do also have like aunties that come from like the Werribee areas, and they're just like, oh, we'll just go and take this to Nasteha. That's what they call me. Like, I'm going to go take this to Nasteha, and Nasteha will feel this, or we'll do this, or we'll do that. Also, my mom is literally the community's mother. So she does a lot, honestly. That woman's amazing. She is babysitters or for like anyone with kids in the communities. And this also like varies. And also like our house is also like some sort of like safe house for communities, both here and also like interstate. So recently we just had like a couple of aunties that were staying at our place, and they were both like running away from like very abusive family, like households, like and really like intense like situations with domestic abuse. So if they need like refuge and things like that, most of them come to like our house, because like the women shelter places are not like also like safe space for them, because like most of them are like in the intersection of like a couple of things, being African, being Muslim, and also like whatever form of like disability that they have. Yeah. They're undiagnosed for a variety of reasons, mostly because when most of the families migrate here, what happens is there isn't really assessment or things like that that happens. They can't go, they are like, oh, let's do like psychological analysis, or let's do like, you know, there's always like the health thing that they do, which is like, oh, they check if you have like often malaria or like diseases, like, you know, sometimes even Ebola and things like that, things that are associated as endemic illnesses with the African continent. And unless you have like a physical like disability, like let's say if you're a wheelchair user, or if you can't, like, you know, if you're blind or if you're deaf, then there's like, they're like, oh, okay, now you can be in this category. But for most of them who come with like, after already, like, you know, also like most of the aunties, especially like the ones from like Sierra Leone, Liberians, and also the ones from Congo and places like that, they already come seeing like war. and they come like being heavily militarized, and there is so much like trauma that they've seen, and they already come here with PTSDs that don't get recognized. And on top of that, also most of them come here when they haven't been schooled. And my mother's a very good example of that. There hasn't been like any assessment to see, okay, they can't read and write. Let's see if there is like, you know, any psychological thing that might be a barrier to that, or might be the reason why they haven't learned. It's always, oh, they probably came from uncivilized place, and because of that, and also because of patriarchy and misogyny and things like that, where like girls are not educated, and there's all this like assumptions about the continent. So that often like leads to like, oh, they didn't have a chance to be schooled, and because of that, that's why they can't read and write. But if we put them, if they're here and we put them in an English school, that means they will be able to like read and write. Most of them have been here for like 17 years, 20 years. My mom has been here for like more than a decade. And some aunties have been here for like 18, 21 and things like that. There's like all these like requirements that are needed in order for you to get like, for example, Centrelink. So one of them might be like, okay, you need to like do 20 hours of schooling. They've been going to English class, like literally since they've been here. Most of them can't read, can't write, and can't speak English. And even when they speak, it's very basic, and that basic, and it's basic with heavy accent. So nobody goes in and asks questions like, oh, we've been teaching them English class for so long, it hasn't worked. Why is that so? Why is it like when this auntie writes, for example, when you ask my mom to write cut, she will write T-A-K, for example. And things like that. There isn't like, oh, why is this the issue? Like those, like the why is never present. And it's never present for various reasons, which is like anti-blackness and also Afrophobia. And there's also this assumption that, oh, they just don't want to learn. There's also like when ageism comes to play, oh, when you're older, your brain slows down a lot. So because of that, you're not like switched on. So we just need to be slower and keep on just like doing this repetitive, like, you know, modes that we've been trying for so long, which haven't worked and are still not working until you're able to like get it. But nobody goes and like, oh, this is associated with dyslexia. Or this is like when, for example, like you ask most of the aunties to write 17, they will write 7 and then 1. It's always like the opposite. And I can never pronounce the word for it, but I think it's a learning disability. It starts with a C, but I can never pronounce it. But all those questions are not asked. So most of them have like undiagnosed learning disabilities, and they themselves don't even know that's what they have. On top of that, they also don't even know, like, they're carrying so much trauma and they have PTSD, and it's not seen as, there hasn't been any support in place for even for most of, like, you know, immigrant African families to be aware of what are the things they themselves are going through, which we often, like, you know, we're the children who have been, like, you know, lucky enough, we've been able to be educated and we've learned about mental illnesses and things like that. So because of that, we're able to be like, oh, okay. So when auntie lashes out after a thing happens, we see like stuff playing out. For example, like my mom, when anything to do with abuse happens in the community, there is a way that she reacts. And it's a reaction before she even says it. And you know that, oh, it's a trigger. I now know that it's a trigger because I've been through the thing. But I did not know it was a trigger when I was growing up. I did not know it was a trigger up until like 5 years. Or even last year, I didn't even know it was a trigger. It is this year that I'm able to be like, aha, that's actually a trigger. So this is what you're going through. Oh, you are acting like this because of, there is so many things that you're going through and you're suffering from, but you're not even able to see it's a suffering because there is nothing in place to tell you and to teach you that these are the things that you've been through. So because of that, like most of them just don't even know that they have disabilities. Yeah. We have like a couple of aunties who have children with Down syndrome, and one particular auntie who is also the one that was, she was unhoused. She was living with my mom for about 2-3 weeks. So for that auntie, she has like children with Down syndrome, autism. Her other child has like multiple forms of learning disabilities and cerebral palsy. For her, there is just so much that she's facing, because it's not just like, on top of like dealing with the system, which is like Centrelink, healthcare. There is also family abuse that happens a lot that I don't think we often talk about it enough in the community. And most of them are also like very financial, physical, and also very psychological. And often because also like fear of like the relationship that we have with police and the relationship that we have with the system in general, aunties don't feel safe about like going and reporting it. So often the responsibilities of like maintaining peace falls back on the elders in the community, who are all men. So often when the aunties come and they complain about the marginalization that they're facing within their own households, it leads to questions such as like, oh, what have you done? And so the children who see that, who also like, you know, they have like disabilities, they get to see their moms being beaten up. They get to see like all this stuff that is happening. So the responsibility of like caring for the children falls wholly on the mothers. That is one thing. And on top of that, there is also like stigma from community. Because, oh, you have a child with Down syndrome, we will pray for you. We will do dua for you. We will, you know, pray Allah, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala do, like, you know, unburden you, because they are seen as burdens. Aunties with children with disabilities don't feel safe going into, like, community spaces, because community spaces are also not safe for them. So these children, on one hand, the homes are not safe because of the abuse that is happening at home. On the other hand, the community is also not safe because when they go into community, they are othered in a way that is very, very, very heartbreaking for the mothers to see. When even they go into community without their children, they still are seen as, oh, you poor thing, how are you? Like, you're still going, like, we are praying for you. We are really praying for you, because having those children are seen as a burden. And so there is all that. And on top of that, aunties also, like, having difficulties, not even accessing, having difficulties in even knowing what type of disability their children have. It's only recently that one of them knew, oh, it's called Down syndrome. Oh, it's called autism. Oh, it's a learning disability that is called dyslexia. Okay, so this is what they have. It's often, especially for the ones that have like cognitive disabilities, there is all this like, oh, there's something wrong with their brain, or there's something wrong with their head, which is also automatically read as, oh, they're crazy. The child is crazy, and there's something wrong with the child. So they themselves also don't even know what form of disability their child has. The fault of this is mostly that of the GPs, because the GPs too, they don't even explain to the mothers, oh, these are the forms of disability that your child has. This is what caused it. And because of this, this is how they are. And for you to be a supportive mother, or for you to care for your child, these are the things that you can do, that you can fall back on in helping you care for the child. These are what they're called. This is where they're located. And you can access them like this and like that. None of that happens. So when you ask questions like, oh, what form of disability does your child have? They're like, oh, I don't know. There's just something wrong with their head. I think that's what I was told. They were probably told this when the child was born, or like the rare times the child comes with disability, because of also like incompetencies of the GPs, and also because of, again, them not being able to like read, write, speak English, to like navigate the system and to know like what are the things that are there for them. It's hard for them to know what support is there for their children. So because of this, most of them don't even know what NDIS is. Most of them that have known very recently what NDIS is hate NDIS. The process has been so grueling and just so heartbreaking. And even when they get there, there is just so much anti-blackness and Afrophobia in the space, even before like applying for the NDIS in general. So often they themselves don't even want to go back to that place, because they don't want to feel how they felt, because there's a lot of infantilizing, a lot of microaggressions, a lot of just humiliation and disrespect that happens in those spaces. It also happens in Centrelink. It happens at hospitals, and it happens also at all other services that they try to like access. So because of this, they're like, I don't want to go through what I went through there, so I'm not going to access it. That also leads to like them not being able to like do what's best for their child through like whatever plans that is there for them to access, because they make it, before they're even able to like access it, the process is already so heartbreaking, and you're already othered, and you're already made to feel so unworthy to be in that space. So because of that, they don't even access it. And most of them, once they like realize, oh, we need to access it because we can no longer, like, we can't afford this. You can't keep on like relying on like, you know, the community's generosity to like help fund and things like that. So they're like, okay, I'm going to get someone like Hamile. We're going to call up NDIS. And we're going to know like, you know, how to apply for this. The process is not clear. It's really not clear. They need to prove that their child has disabilities. They need to prove that this Down syndrome that they have, or the autism that they have, or the cognitive disabilities that their child has, it's permanent. I don't know how permanent it's measured. It's not clear. And on top of that, after going through the process, going back and forth, simultaneously dealing with the anti-blackness and the Afrophobia and the misogynoir in the space. So often they apply for the process, they apply for accessing NDIS. For most of them, I don't think they've still heard back anything from. Most of them are still like, they keep calling back every couple of weeks and what they hear back, it's still being reviewed. And when they ring back again, they're like, oh, hold up. And then the phone has been hanged. The rare times that it has been accepted, they often get letters again telling them that they need to reapply again. Because I do most of the forms, I need to explain to them what it says. Even if I explain to them what the forms say or like what is required of them, they get confused. The GPs being as useless as they are and as incompetent as most of them are, what happens is they haven't explained to the parents again, like the disability of the child. So when you're doing the forms, they also are learning about their children in the forms. And so it's back and forth between Centrelink, NDIS, GP, and sometimes most of them need to go see a specialist. So you need to also book an appointment. And because it's also like most of them are public, they are on the waiting list. If you had, let's say, a deadline because you're on the waiting list and you still haven't had anything, you need to go back again and restart the process again, which is like really, really heartbreaking. And this is for people that can't speak, read, and write the language. So you are explaining to them. It just makes them feel useless. And most of them just like, we are on a train and you will just see most of them just like breaking down and crying. And then just feeling like this is like, you know, if I knew how to read and write, I would have worked and my child wouldn't have needed to access these useless services and things like that. And they blame themselves for being incompetent parents and all that stuff. It's just, yeah, it's intense. And this is also, so for the children, I feel like they suffer the most. And on top of that, often what happens is like for most of them, they have like carers, disability workers that come, and this is it is supposed to relieve the carer, who are mostly like the aunties doing the caring for a couple of hours or like for the day. So they can like, you know, tend to other things, or they can do like chores and things like that. And the child has someone that is caring for them. There has been cases of abuse. Not one, not two, not three, not seven, not 10. There has been so many cases of abuse. This does not include the fact that some of the children have been like abused in shelters that are supposed to be like safe for them and their families when they were unhoused or when they were homeless. So because often like the carers, like, you know, there has been cases where like a child has been quote unquote disciplined by the carer, and there has been like marks, and this leads to like the already believed, how do I put this? There's already this belief in the community that, especially for people, for families with children with disabilities, that nobody can care for that child except for them, because they cannot trust anybody else. And they have every right not to trust everybody else, because over and over and over again, they have been proved they are right in not trusting anybody else. So when these carers, quote unquote, discipline the child, because that's what they always say. They're like, oh, we were just like, you know, the child was being naughty, or the child was, they don't even say naughty. They often say the child was being crazy. That's the word that they use. They always say, oh, the child was being crazy and I was trying to hold on and I got beaten, or like, this has happened to me. And because of that,
like, you know, I was trying to just calm him down or calm her down, and then this is how they end up getting the mark. And you're like, why were you calming them, like, you know, behind their thighs, like, or, like, you know, on their buttocks? Like, what kind of, like, calming down method or, like, strategy is that? So, and most of the parents know their children, and then they know their children that the only time, like, their children, what's the proper language for this, are seen as difficult is when they have, when the person engaging with the child has done something to dishonor the child. That has always been the case. It has always been the case where, like, the child has been dishonored, the child, like, something has, the carer or the person, whoever it is that is engaging the child, has done something to trigger the child in a way that leads to the child acting the way the child acts. But the responsibility automatically falls back on the child. And because also some of them, and in most cases has been with those with who are mute, and the parent knows their child, but when they explain this to whoever sent the carer, they often go, no, like, you're lying. You're obviously, like, you know, they gaslight them. There's a lot of gaslighting that happens where they go, no, you're not being rational, or I don't think you are not there, so how would you know? Maybe sometimes we think we know our children, but we don't really know our children. And the child gets painted in a very particular picture. Or and the onus gets placed on the child, and the child bears the responsibility. So the issue doesn't become, oh, there is an abuse that took place. It's seen as, no, the carer was afraid for his or her life, and the child is the one that was threatening, and the carer just defended themselves. It's not seen as abuse. So there has been a lot of cases like that, which has led to most of them, rightfully so, to feel not safe to leave their child with someone else that is not them or that they truly trust, and the child also knows. And also this whole thing of, like, today the carer is a brown person, tomorrow the carer is a white person, the next day the carer is a black person. Like, every single time, like, changing carers with the children is also has, like, for most of them, they're like, no, like, you're confusing my child. Like if it's one carer, let it be one carer so the child can get used to it and they can, like, earn the trust of the child. Often, in most cases, in all cases, they see the babies as these monsters that needs to be managed and maintained. So it doesn't matter who they send. They don't see the child as a human being. They don't see the child as someone that has right to, like, you know, to consent to whoever it is that is supposed to care for them and things like that. And there is all, like, all this, like, assumptions that they already have about the babies. So because of that, aunties are like, no, we don't feel safe leaving our children with carers and strangers that we don't know. So we're going to care for our children. And in times where it's necessary for us to, like, be at a place without them, we're going to leave them with somebody that we trust. Often, in most cases, it happens to be, like, someone like my mom. So they leave the child with my mom for some time, or my mom goes to their house and, like, you know, cares for them until, like, the parent comes back. The government and the, like, you know, the Department of Human Services, etc., they see this as, oh, you are telling us that you are fully capable of caring for your child, and also you're telling us that you're fully capable of not just caring for your child, but then also simultaneously being responsible for everything, and also being responsible for, equipped with taking care of everything. So you don't need our help. You have all this under the control. Cool. So they see this as, oh, rejection of help. They call it help. Yeah, they see it as a rejection of help. So often what that leads to is like, okay, so if you're telling us that you no longer require these services, then we're not going to give you these services, which also leads to, like, other services being cut from them, because they see them refusing their child being accessed by strangers as them rebelling against the system. So again, a lot of, like, financial issues come up. Again, a lot of things come up for them in terms of, like, oh, there is already this belief that my child is seen as, and my, like, you know, my children or my child is seen as a danger to society, and already my child is othered on fronts, on multiple fronts, fronts of being poor, fronts of, like, being African or black, fronts of, most especially, being a child with a form of disability or multiple forms of disability. So because of this, they already disbelieve that, okay, no, like nobody cares about me and my child except for myself. And they often, because of this, they're like, okay, I'm just going to stay and seclude myself and just like not interact with community because, again, community is super ableist. And also, I'm not going to go outside, so I'm just going to like protect my child. And the best thing I know how to protect my child is to stay in this house. And this is what I'm going to do. And it leads to like also them not getting like care payment, that most of them get taken off care payments and they put back on New Start allowances or the family tax, I think family tax benefit, that's the one that they get put back on. It's not enough. And once that happens, is especially for the ones that, the kids that go to like special school, this leads to like a lot of things being cut off for them. And one of those things is like, I know like there's a school down at Dandenong where my niece goes and they have like art practices and things like that that they do. But there are things that, programs that are, that you can access if you have, if your family like receives a particular type of payment. So when that payment has been cut, that also affects the well-being of the child, not just in like, you know, in society and at home, but then also at school. So the child is othered on multiple fronts. So I often feel like African children with disabilities or multiple forms of disability around the southeastern part of the place, Melbourne, they suffer most, but it's just so layered and you don't even know where to begin.
Now we'll hear of a very different experience of disability. Pauline Vituna recently caught up with Vira Muzotsa at a community barbecue at Edinburgh Park. In this impromptu interview, Vira discusses choosing self-management of the NDIS plan for her son with autism, culture and more.
My name is Vira Muzotsa. I'm Zimbabwean. I came to Australia in October 2006. And I have an 11-year-old son. He was born in September 2008. And I found out about his autism diagnosis when, let's see, after his second birthday. And how it came about was, I knew he couldn't hear me, so I thought he actually had a hearing issue, not so much autism. So when we went to the specialists at Royal Children's Hospital, we went to the communications wing and they did their tests, and then after that they told me that, oh, your son is autistic. But it hadn't really sunk in because I still believe that he still could not hear me. So I don't think I actually heard the diagnosis that he's autistic. I just believe that he cannot hear. It did turn out that his hearing is impaired. So he's autistic, has a bilateral hearing impairment or sensorineural hearing loss, a lot of words. And after getting into school, they now say he's also got intellectual disability because of, you know, his learning processes. But that's where it's at the moment. Yeah.
And you were talking before about the fact that you're going to Zimbabwe.
Yes. Right. So, you know, like I said, I'm Zimbabwean. There are traditional things that I do on my own and things that he's used to. And unfortunately, the carers who'll be coming in, they wouldn't know how to do that. I mean, some don't even know how to cook rice. So, I mean, go figure. So going home, because food is so central in our community, so going home is important and it's a wonderful experience because he gets to see, actually, he gets to be independent of me and I independent of him. And I know he'll be okay because he's got people, one, who look like me, black like me, and people who speak the same language that I speak to him with. And he doesn't have to worry about being hungry because mom is not going to be able to cook sadza for him or, you know, with the stew or spinach and peanut butter, things like that. So it's been It's wonderful because last year when I went, my mom literally took me out of the house and she took me to Victoria Falls, and I was not allowed to be on the phone or to find out if he's okay. She just said that, no, we have to intervene because you're coddling him too much. But it's that thing of me letting go of him. Because children his age, they're letting go of their moms and, you know, they're going to play. But with him, it's different. He's dependent on him, and I'm dependent on him being dependent on me. So I'm having to let go and just trust that, you know, he's becoming his own little adult, little boy or man, whichever. And, just learning to let go and let him grow, find out things and learn from other people, not so much mom, you know. So it's always beautiful when I go home. I'm looking forward to it.
We're talking about self-management and the NDIS.
Yes, right. So we had early intervention, which is first year funding. That ends when the child turns 7, and then after that, you'd be reliant on donors and such. But after, I think, some 4 years, that's when NDIS was being rolled out. So we were fortunate enough because it's just me and him. So I think it goes through certain tiers, like what the people we urgently needed. So generally, it was quite taxing. Okay. It was quite taxing because it takes such a long time. You're having to chase up reports and things like that, making sure that they're saying the right thing so that you can get the right amount of funding. Because sometimes they might see him today. That's the thing with autism. They might see him today and he's absolutely happy, beautiful, and it's all wonderful. But then the next day, totally different thing. It's like on the other end of the scale. So it's making sure that those things are accounted for and they're not just having a picture of him being happy all the time when that's actually not the case. So I think in that regard, that was great. And then the reason why I insisted on self-managing is whilst we were on first year funding, I remember I requested for him to have an iPad to aid in his communication because, as I said, he has a hearing loss and is learning a bit of the Makaton type of sign language because it's very simple. And the speech therapist believed that he didn't need the iPad just yet because he was too young and it was unnecessary. But then the funding is for him, you know, so it's them putting their personal or maybe personal professional opinions onto the situation. Whereas when you're self-managing, I don't need that. If I feel that's what he needs, then I can just go out there and get it for him or get a quotation and get it done. So I find it that there's much more flexibility and even accountability, you know, on my part, because I'm making sure that he's using those things to the maximum and it's not just something random for someone who's read in a book that, oh, autistic children need this when they are 12, but yet I know he needs it now to familiarize himself first, and then he'll have more range of use when he knows his way around the iPad. Yeah.
What does he like?
It's always a hard one, because one day he likes this and he doesn't. He definitely loves food. And the reason why he loves Zimbabwean food is because it involves using his hands when he's eating. So that's really good. Oh, you should see him. You should watch him when he's eating. It's like, I don't know, he's eating this food that's out of this world. He's putting his hands into it and he's putting it in his mouth. And, you know, he's rubbing his lips. It's... It is so cute. Like, it's really... Because, you know, he's... What is it? Like, the sensory feedback of molding. It's called sadza. It's mealy milk cooked until it's about stiff. Yeah, you know it. Yeah, so he's really working his hands on it like putty. So that's good for his hands. And then he's eating it, and of course, in his stomach. And it's just a wholesome feeling for him. So, yeah, food is such a big thing. It's such a huge motivator. And he loves movement, so long drives. He enjoys that. Like, yesterday... I drove from home to Queenscliff, Geelong, and then we got on the ferry. Then we drove from Sorrento, stopped off in Rai. We went to the beach. You know, there's like the back beach. It's, I think the waters are much wilder, I would say. They're not like the beautiful beaches in Modialok. It's not like soft like that. The waters are hard and they're rowing. He loves the sand. So that's a whole, that's a beautiful day for him because he's really happy when things are going well. He loves movement. And what else? Did I say food? Just for emphasis. Of late, he's been enjoying navigating Netflix, especially with the touch screen. So you see the iPad touch screen, watching Shrek. Shrek 2 is what he watches every night. So now, thank God to NDIS and self-managing, I've managed to buy him even a portable DVD. Just in case Netflix is not working where we are or there's no electricity, I have a backup plan. Because with autism, if that doesn't work, I can't explain to him why it's not working. He wouldn't understand that. So I always have to have those things in place. Yeah, I think for now, that's about it. And collecting water bottles. I don't know how many water bottles I have in my house right now. And I'm always having to throw them out. Yeah, just a thing. Like, he loves, it makes him feel grounded when he's carrying things. So that's where it's from. It's always trying to ground himself. Yeah. Yeah.
You're leaving soon to go?
Yeah, because we went last year and my mother's place, it's got like, you know, I think 3 toilets. He couldn't use any of them and it just felt unfamiliar for him. And he's someone who can independently use the bathroom. And, you know, it's not the best feeling when you're wearing nappies and it's hot. And he just found a dish and decided to just use that as his bathroom. So in the end, we just used that. Although a lot of people are uncomfortable, because majority of the time, I'm not worried about him, but I'm worried about everyone else and how they perceive it, how they see it, and their judgment of me as a parent, then also him having special needs and such. So this time around, I've done my homework. So I've managed to buy a toilet seat similar to the one we have home, which is under, you know, consumables. So hopefully he'll use that. If he's not able to use that, I've got like a camping toilet. So that I'm going to have to send separately. So, you know, with NDIS, it's great that I'm able to do things like that, because I don't know if you understand dignity of risk. Yeah. It's always trying to make sure that I am allowing him to be himself and have a dignified space the same way that I would want it, but making those little provisions for him. And I also created a WhatsApp group where I have key people like my parents, the 2 women who are going to be looking after him, and my partner and his sister, because I'm going to be visiting a lot of them. And just explaining to him what autism is, what his what are the things that he needs, and also explaining that, you know, the little discomfort that we might have personally, it's less than how he's going to feel and his experience. So it's so important for him to have a beautiful experience because he is going on a holiday. But I don't want it to become a thing where he associates that place as being difficult and inaccessible. So I think, yeah, having NDIS and self-managing has allowed me to do all that. And having to have all those little things in place, it's been great. Yeah. So even getting waterproof bedding in case, you know, accidents. But yeah, I'm looking forward to it this time around. Better than last year, because it was a nightmare. Yeah.
Has a blessed time.
Oh, I'm sure he's going to have one. Because my partner, he's got a farm and we were there last year. He loved it. Just, you know, running in nature, like we are here at the Edinburgh Gardens. There's not much traffic compared to Harare. Harare, it's a lot of traffic, it's chaos, and it's used to a bus just going straight, not weaving through potholes or hooting here, a driver just cutting through wherever. So I'm just trying to create like a little itinerary for him where it's more predictable as well. So man, it's a lot of work. And NDIS needs to start paying me too. This is beyond mothering. Just kidding, and yes, we love you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you too. I'm excited. I hope this helps and inspires other black women out there and people of color, because this is really good. Yeah.
Sirius Meerkat joined Pauline Vituna in the 3CR studio to discuss her lived experience of trauma and non-Western modalities of healing.
It's a journey I'm realizing and I'm learning, and I'm still going through it. I'm still uncovering new information and I'm still trying to navigate it. I found myself taking medication, and at the time I understand how, you know, when you're in crisis, it's something to help you get back to your baseline levels, right? So you can deal with what's going on. And I don't deny the usefulness of that. And I think we shouldn't be afraid to take that on and see how that's like a negative thing. Because that was one of the things for me, you know, I'm like, I'm weak, I'm broken, there's something wrong with me if I'm going to need something external to help me get through this. And that's not a good relationship to have with anything, really. But I think in terms of medication, we have a complex relationship with it. And that comes with a lot of baggage and a lot of thoughts around what that means for you, right? So if you're looking at it through a dichotomy of Western medicine, cultural medicine, and I put like air quotes, because that's already a vast discipline and that's shaped by so many things. If you look at it as like a binary, it can close you off to a lot of opportunities for healing and learning new knowledge. So for me, it was, I had to get rid of that relationship that I had with medication and say, okay, I need to do this to help myself get through this. It's like an extra support, right? But then as I'm taking this medication, I'm seeing a few things. One of which, for me, the side effects were worse than before I had it. And it was more, so say for example, the particular medication I was taking was called Pristiq. And if you look it up, there's been some very interesting results that came up in the clinical trials. And you look at the limited pool of people that they actually looked at. So I kept getting caught in this fight with my doctor, because I would say, look, I'm feeling this, I'm taking this medication, I guess I'm a bit more stable, but there's these other things that are coming up. So say, for example, one of the side effects is you feel like there's rocks in your head. So every time you kind of bend your head, it's like a swooshing sound. So you're constantly sort of trying to navigate your balance. Or if you miss a dose sometimes, you know, by accident, which can happen, you get intense nausea, and that suicidal ideation actually almost triples, like when they look at the stats. So you start to question and go, okay, so I'm on this medication, which is supposed to be helping me with certain things, but it seems to be exacerbating certain things. For me, the lesson in that was, that's when I had to learn to listen to my own body. Because the whole time I'd sort of been functioning from a position of the doctor knows best, which is a very, I think, Western way of thinking about professionals and people with expertise. So I had to let go of that. At the time, I was also doing a type of therapy called CBT, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, this is a massive distillation of it, but essentially it looks at your thoughts and asks you to change them. And for me, I felt like I couldn't connect with it, because I'm thinking, I'm having these things come up, they're presenting in my body, these thoughts are presenting in my mind. I can't just switch them. Like, I felt like I had to understand why they were coming up, because for me, I think that was key. Because obviously, you know, we all have a critical voice. We all have things that, you know, sometimes put us down, or that we have difficulty facing or are challenged by. But I feel like if you just sort of go, yep, change your thought, change, like switch a channel and you'll be fine. I don't think it's, for me, it didn't seem to capture the healing that I needed to do. And that was like almost, I'd say 6 years ago. And then I tried DBT, which is dialectical behavioral therapy. That was massive in terms of transformation because it came from a place of understanding why you were having the thoughts that you were having and why you were feeling the feelings you were having. And for me, that, again, even emphasized that relationship that I had to have with myself and my body to trust myself and listen to myself. Because I think one thing that sort of gets underplayed is how the body is so intelligent and it has its own memories, and everything we've experienced is embedded within ourselves, right? The body remembers, which is one of the books that I've been reading to help with my healing. And so I was like, okay, now I've kind of got a more holistic view. And I think I've always sort of had that. I didn't even realize. I was always interested in the bigger picture. Because I'm like, I'm not interested in just looking at the incident of this PTSD and how it's changed my life. I kind of need to have context and all of that. So I think that was built into me already, I guess, from my background, because I'm mad. But it's not in an explicit way, I think. And that's where I sort of started to see how cultural knowledge was really important in terms of healing, because, you know, our ancestors, they didn't have words like DBT or depression. They didn't use those words as such, right, in those specific terms as we know them. But they had mechanisms that always focused on keeping a person whole. And I think that's something that maybe Western medicine kind of overlooks, because you just treat the symptom of a problem. So medication to treat this particular symptom. And some people are on medication for all their lives and they don't feel as empowered. But I think it's more about the reason why you're doing something, right? And how it's actually helping you as a whole. So for me, I found if I can learn more and go out there and tap into culture as like part of my self-love and self-healing, that would help me understand more and know more and help myself forgive myself more and be more understanding of myself. Because I think when you kind of treat a symptom, it's almost like you're just looking at a robot that you expect to be working at full functionality all the time and say, once you get the pills, you're back on. But it's actually not like that. Healing is sort of like a zigzag journey. You know, there's twists and turns and all of that. So the more I started, to take on that self-advocacy role, I started to see the importance of culture as part of self-care and self-healing. And I think one of the biggest things also was learning about healers in the community, and finding that, you know, healing is not just within the medical system. It's there, but it's also in other places too. So that's where I'm at right now, trying to find the healers. The colonial experience has disconnected Shona people from their culture quite a lot. So you even look at how English is my first language, and then you speak Shona at home. So even the educational system in Zimbabwe is set up that way. So it's hard to try and think of a specific thing, right? Like, or a specific practice that we say we've employed for a certain amount of years, or that, you know, our family or our heritage or our lineage does. But I'll say it's inherent in every time we get together, we eat amazing food cooked by the wonderful matriarchs and sometimes the patriarchs as well. And I really appreciate that. So everyone's kind of involved in that process. And we dance our asses off like crazy. And we sit around and we talk, we tell stories. This sort of like this thing of, it's one of my favorite things about getting together with the family. It's like the elders talk and then like us young people can like ask questions. And sometimes, you know, be a little bit controversial and like push the envelope and, you know, watch their reactions. But this exchange of knowledge and interaction that we have with each other. And I see how some of that healing methodology may actually be present in that. Because, I mean, I always feel better after it. But it's funny because when you're going through something like this, you don't always feel better. And I think that's an interesting dichotomy, that when you're going through something like this, being in the West, communities view differently. But yeah, so there's like those things that are sort of inherent in the culture. But yeah, I'm very interested in kinesiology and that massage therapy style of healing, because I think it's intimately connected, absolutely. Probably the biggest message for me coming out of this, or the biggest learning coming out of this, is learning to trust myself. And if we're coming off the back of the idea that the body remembers and you pass down this knowledge, then you could say you have your ancestral knowledge that lives within you and it's there. Like, think of, say, for example, crying, right? And how it's, you know, people, there's a negative connotation to crying. You know, women, if they cry, they're being too emotional. Men, if they cry, they're being weak. But if you think about it, that's the first language that you spoke. And there's a reason for that. It's your body's way of communicating something, if anything. So if you can learn to work with that and not against it, because I feel like if you're just looking at medication as a way to erase what you're feeling, or therapy to get rid of what you're thinking and feeling, I think it's going to be a lot harder for you. So if you can learn to speak the language of your body and what lies within it, I think that's been key for me. I don't always do it, but I'm learning.
You've just listened to Africans with Disabilities in NAM, a 1-hour special for 3CR's Disability Day broadcast for 2019. I'm Ayan Shirwa. Stay tuned for more Power from the Margins.